There we go. Now we're good to go. Again,
right.
Nesbitt, your moderator, and we're talking with Camille Minichino, our speaker on writing and selling and promoting the mystery series. Camille, it's so good to have you on the call.
Yes, thank you. Thank you a lot.
And you are a best-selling author of, I think, one of the most unique approaches to a mystery series. It's a mystery series based on the periodic table.
That's my first series, right.
And
I have 8 books in that series, and I started, of course, with the hydrogen murder. My background's in physics. I have a PhD in physics. But I also have a liberal arts background, you know, the kind that tells you you should do everything. You know, you should be the Renaissance woman. So that's what I've kind of been striving for. And eventually, about 15 years ago, writing came to the fore, and I just decided to do some fiction writing. I'd always loved to read. And so my first thought was my background in physics and the periodic table, and I started a series, hydrogen murder, helium murder, lithium murder, right on through, planning to do 111 of them. I have 8 of them already.
And you're still surging forward.
I'm surging forward. But in the meantime, my publisher wanted another series, so I chose a new name, and I launched a different series based on my hobby of dollhouses and miniatures. So my new series, my new name is Margaret Grace, much easier to pronounce, thank you. And Margaret Grace authors the Dollhouse Mystery Series, where the protagonist, instead of being a physicist, as in the first series, is a miniaturist. She makes little room boxes and scenes and dollhouses and has a granddaughter who serves as her partner in solving crimes. So those are my two series. I have 12 books. I just finished my 12th one, actually, at about 2 in the morning on Tuesday and sent it off for critiquing before I actually sent it to my editor. So it's, you know, it just feels so good when you finish a book and you write the end. Even though you know there's a lot more editing to do, it's a finished product now, and I can work with it that way.
Gracious. That's fantastic, and congratulations. And you have written scientific articles on things that I can't even pronounce. And you've also written a memoir, The Boston Brave.
I did. I've written some memoirs and a lot of other personal essays that have appeared. One appeared in Ms. Magazine and a baseball journal. And, of course, my first publication was a book on waste management, nuclear waste management, when I was auditing nuclear power plants about 20 years ago. So that was my first book, and I think that's what sold me on having a book with my name on it. I have to say that was not a bestseller, nuclear waste management, but, you know, most libraries bought it, and, of course, science labs. But it kind of gave me this taste for, wow, a book with your name on the spine, isn't this exciting? But if I really want to be in Barnes & Noble, I need to write something else. So that's when I started my fiction career.
Oh, fantastic. Well, let us get started then on writing, selling, and promoting the mystery series. For those of you who are just joining us, we're talking with Camille Minichino, also the author of the mystery series based on the periodic table, Oxygen Murder, the Lithium Murder, etc., and also Margaret Grace, pen name for a series on miniatures and murder in miniature, mayhem in miniature. So tell us, Margaret, Camille, how do we get started on writing the mystery series?
You know, I actually have kind of divided my little presentation into 3 parts. How do you get started writing a mystery? How do you write a mystery? Then how do you sell it to an agent or a publisher? And finally, how do you promote it? So starting with writing it, I'm very, very lucky because I can write anywhere, anytime. I think that it started with my having to do my homework on the Boston's MTA when I was going to college in Boston and living in a suburb. And so I did all my homework on the subway, pretty much. And now I can actually write. If I have 10 minutes between one event and another, I can focus and write 10 minutes worth and then go to the next thing. Not everyone can do that. I heard Rocky Hill this morning, and she likes to have time early in the morning, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning, very quiet. And one thing that I learned early, it took me a little while to learn it, is that it doesn't really matter. If you have the personality that requires you to have a very quiet environment and you want to get up before anyone else's, that's fine. If you want to just work in a coffee shop, that's fine. The important thing is write. For many years, I thought you had to get up at 4 and right before the kids were awake. And I thought, well, I can't get up at 4. I guess I can't be a writer. But of course, that's not true. As long as you find your own rhythm and find a way to get things down on paper or on the computer now, then you can do it. So I also learned a great lesson from Eric Mizell. I was at a seminar once of his where he essentially, he made the claim that if you really tried, you could refocus in 7 seconds. Imagine that. So that's what I've learned to do. Essentially, I can go from one zone to another in just a few seconds, and I can make the most of any time that I have. So given that, write any time, find your own way to write, find your own place to write. If you're interested in writing a mystery, you have to isolate for yourself what subgenre you're in. It's not enough to say, I'm going to write a mystery, not a romance, or a mystery, not science fiction, or a mystery and not a how-to travel easily. You have to go through lots and lots of subgenres in crime fiction. Writer's Digest, about beginning of the summer, put out an article with dozens and dozens of subgenres, for example, in mystery and crime. You might want to write a courtroom drama, a thriller, a police procedural, an amateur detective, a classic whodunit, a historical, a medical thriller, an espionage thriller. All of these are different subgenres. You have to know what you're writing because each one of them has different conventions that go with it. In a cozy, for example, which is what I write, there's no graphic violence or sex. You kind of fade to black when it comes to focusing on the body or on a romantic relationship. So you have to know the conventions of a cozy, that you're not allowed to put in graphic sex scenes. This doesn't mean you can't write a mystery with sex scenes. You just have to look and call that something else, and you would call that exactly romantic mystery or romantic suspense. The important thing about knowing this is that when you go to try to sell this book to an agent or a publisher, you have to be able to tell them where you fit in a list of subgenres. The first 2 words in your query letter are going to be, this is a whodunit, this is a police procedural, and so on, so that they know immediately whether you follow the conventions. You can't kill an animal, for example, in a cozy. You can if you're writing a techno thriller. So it's very important to learn the subgenres and learn what the conventions are so that you follow it. And I'll get to this later, but there are a lot of ways to finding this out. The mystery community has many, many organizations that you can belong to, meetings every single week, and lots of assistance and critique groups for people starting out writing a mystery. They help you focus. They help you figure out your subgenre, refine your subgenre, and keep to the conventions. And they tell you the protocol of finding an agent to go with your subgenre. Now, actually writing the story itself, like any other piece of fiction, you need to worry about your character, your setting, and your plot. For your character, you choose a detective, or it could be a police person or a cozy. Mine are cozy, mostly because I'm not a cop. I have cops on my payroll, so to speak, in that I call them a lot for help, and I belong to a lot of online groups where forensics experts and policemen and policewomen answer questions immediately. It's a wonderful resource. But I don't want to write a police procedural the way, for example, Michael Connelly does, because he covered the police beat for Los Angeles for many years, or Lee Lofton, who is actually a cop. I don't want to have to worry about the details of police procedure. So my character is, in fact, either a retired physicist, as she is in the first series, or my miniaturist, a retired English teacher, in the second series. They then bumble around, think Miss Marple or Jessica Fletcher in Murder, She Wrote, and they're very snoopy and they help the police. So you develop your character according to, again, what subgenre you're interested in. Whichever kind of character you have, whether he's a cop or a blood spatter expert like Dexter and Jeff Lindsay series, you have to have a character arc. Again, like as in any other fiction, your character has to change through the story. Even though in a mystery the plot revolves around here's a crime and a victim, and here's a sleuth who tries to solve the crime. Even so, your sleuth has to have an arc. She or he has to go, for example, from being very shy in the beginning, but gets involved somehow in investigation, maybe because a relative is accused of it unjustly, and she has to go from being shy to being brave, or being cowardly to being brave, or shy to outgoing. She has to change through the book, or no one cares. You can't have a cardboard detective, that might as well be a computer. So you develop your character arc. Your setting also, your setting is almost a character in itself. My first series for the periodic table series, I chose a real city of Revere, Massachusetts, where I grew up, right outside of Boston, the first public beach in the country, about 110 years old. And I loved writing about where I grew up. However, there are problems. I now live 3,000 miles from where I grew up, so I had to do a lot of emailing back and forth to people who still live there. I travel there, which I love to do, but I had to worry about whether Tuttle Street was one way or whether Broadway was a mile long or 3 miles long. And when I started my second series, therefore, I decided to create a fictional town. I just made it up. I called it Lincoln Point, California. And it doesn't exist. This means I can make the streets any way I want as long as I'm consistent. So I don't have to worry about that. However, again, didn't want a bland, no-name town that doesn't exist. So I called it Lincoln Point, and I made the town Lincoln-obsessed. That is, there are quotes from Abraham Lincoln in all the public buildings. They reenact the Lincoln-Douglas debates in February. They celebrate Mary Todd Lincoln's birthday in December. And my plots revolve around many, many Lincoln events so that it gives the town character. If you're writing about a famous town, say New York City, then it's very difficult to avoid just being a tour guide through the city. So you want to find some unique thing about it. For example, make one of your characters a subway worker and let us see New York City from somewhere where we don't usually go. So whatever your setting is, give it character itself. If you're going to set your book in Hawaii, which everyone thinks he or she knows about, give us a pineapple worker, or give us a hotel worker, or give us the person who prepares the feast for the luau. Give us an angle on it that we haven't seen before. So your character has to grow, your setting has to be a character, and give us some interesting things to look at. The plotting, of course, depends on the genre. In a whodunit, you lay clues all the way, you point people in different directions, you have a number of suspects, and then in the end, all is revealed. It's a kind of a formula that's a very comfortable formula. Since most of my books have written to this, I'm comfortable doing it, and I can write a book in about 2 months. This doesn't mean I hope that they're formula in the sense of boring, because the characters are different, the plots are different. But the whodunit structure is a very classic structure. The other classic structure is the thriller structure. The thriller, it doesn't require as much plotting because essentially it's a chase. You know, you can just start out with this person is going to blow up Los Angeles or blow up New York City, and the good guy has to find a way to stop it. And that's the, quote, formula. And even though we call it a formula, again, you might as well say, for example, that houses have formulas. Houses have floors and walls and ceilings and roofs and doors, and a couple of other things. But given that structure and that formula, you can have the Taj Mahal, you can have a cabin at Lake Tahoe, or just a tract home or a ranch-style home. They're all very, very different from each other, but the structure is the same, floors, ceilings, walls. And it's the same for writing a mystery. The structure is there, the structure for each genre or subgenre is there, but they're all going to be different because you'll have a different character with a different arc, a different setting, and different plotting. Different things will go wrong. So that's about, you know, all I want to say right now for how to write the mystery. Again, I'd be happy to take questions on that. But those are the basic parts of how you sit down and write it. One other thing about that is that when I first started, I took a mystery that I thought I could have written, a mystery that I wish I'd written, and I tore it apart. I analyzed it from page one to the end. I analyzed it chapter by chapter. Chapter one, how many pages, how many characters? Chapter two, how many new characters are introduced? Where's the first clue? Where do you meet the actual killer? When do you meet the suspects? I did a complete breakdown, possibly from my scientific background. I tend to be very analytic, but this is a very good way to write a book in a genre like mysteries. You see what works, you see what you would like to do, and then you copy it, essentially. Excuse me, I'm sorry, I have to take a little... The second part, then, is selling it. How do you sell this wonderful book that you've written to an agent or a publisher? My own process was I finished my first book, I sent it out to about 25 agents and small press. You can't really send to a big press unless you have an agent, but you can get a small press to publish it. And I chose to do that. The first two books are with a small press in New York, and once I had two books written, I was able to get an agent, a New York agent. Your query package, all of the things, all of the protocol that you should really know, that you should be learning even as you write the book, are available through many, many resources. In the mystery community, if you're writing a mystery, you are in luck because there are so many different groups. Sisters in Crime, for one thing, which is a national organization started by Sarah Paretsky. And even though it sounds like a feminist group, it was started to promote the work of women who were not getting reviewed as much as men and whose books were not on the shelves in quantities as men. However, Sisters in Crime, of course, admits men and women. I have been president of my local chapter, and in fact, I came between two men. Mystery writer Mark Coggins was before me, and mystery writer Simon Wood was after me. So it's a very egalitarian group and a very, very supportive group, Sisters in Crime. Mystery Writers of America is another group to think about joining. They are the more professional organization, and you can't be an active member until you have published a mystery. But they are the equivalent of other professional societies which will offer you, for example, health insurance through there. So they're the professional group, Mystery Writers of America. There are also subgenre groups. There's the International Thriller Writers, the Private Eye Writers. And I can't emphasize enough the value these organizations offer. Not only do you find critique partners for your work through these groups, but you hear professionals, you hear agents, you hear editors when you go to the meetings, and you learn the protocol. You have people who will look at your query letter and say, no, 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 this should be in paragraph four. Or, no, 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 don't ever put this word up in this. That's not a good buzzword. So you learn all of that through joining the organizations and attending the meetings. Which brings us again to promoting the book. Promoting the book, we're always surprised to know, takes about as much time as writing it, possibly more. There are five things that are pretty critical to promoting your book. The first one is to have a website. Probably everyone has a website these days. I think when you go into daycare, you get your own website. So you need a website of your own that showcases yourself, your biography. You can whatever you want to show on there. If your mysteries are based on art, then you put pictures that have inspired you about that. Your website is your presentation to the universe that you can't physically go to and visit. Number two, as I've said, is to join organizations. Join in the mystery community the organizations that I've already mentioned. Number three is you do have to show up now and then and not just work through your website. And the guideline is pretty much that within about 100-mile radius of your home, every bookstore and librarian should know you. Every bookseller and every library community events or friends of a library person should know who you are and have your book. This means you drive there, you give them a copy of your book, you introduce yourself. We could talk about tchotchkes, which many, many mystery writers do, making bookmarks with your book cover. I have pens, I have rulers, periodic tables that I produced in a very handy purse and pocket size, with, of course, my books listed on the back. So everyone in within 100 miles of your home should know who you are. You should set up events there. You should visit. You drop off tchotchkes, and you contact them. The other reason for joining something like Sisters in Crime is that you get to be part of a speakers bureau. Your name goes into the speakers bureau, and when a library or a bookstore or the local AAUW or AAUM, or when the local events persons need a speaker, they go to Sisters in Crime or to MWA and they say, we need an author, and your name is on that list. And then you drive out to that bookstore and you make a contact with the bookseller. So you can either, it's better, of course, than cold calls or cold appearances, but you end up doing both. Right now, I'm the Speakers Bureau Coordinator for Sisters in Crime in my area. Requests. I get all of the requests for a speaker, and I line them up and send them out. And, of course, I go out myself. There are conferences, probably one a week, that you could go to throughout the country. I go to at least four a year. The largest mystery conference is called BoucherCon. It's named after Anthony Boucher, an early mystery reviewer. And another one is called Malice Domestic, which deals with cozies, as in domestic. That's in Washington every year. Mayhem in the Midlands is in Omaha every year. There's Sleuth Fest in Florida. And Boise, Idaho has Murder in the Grove. So you can't, of course, travel budgets usually don't allow you to go to all of them, but you pick ones, you attend each one at least once, so that over a three-year period, you've been to all the conferences. And you do this before your book is out to introduce yourself. So now you've been promoting by having a website, by networking through organizations, and by physically showing up at bookstores, libraries, and conferences. The fourth thing is blogging. As we all know, this is the buzzword these days, and who are you if you're not blogging? So you either have your own blog on your website or you join others. I've chosen, because it's a little easier, I'm part of a group called Killer Hobbies. We're all hobby-related mysteries. We have a quilter and a scrapbooker and a needlepoint worker and a crocheter, and we take a day a week. There are seven of us. I blog on Tuesdays. So this way, readers and people who visit blogs like a new blog every day. This way, you blog once a week, but your readers will see a new blog every day. And so I find this, right now, this works for me. Some people have both. They have a blog on their website, and they also blog with a group. The idea is to get buzz going. You visit other people's blogs. So blogging doesn't just mean you sit there and post your own thoughts for the day, but you actually, through what I use is Google, I use Google Alerts. So Google will alert me every time the word dollhouse is mentioned in the universe, or every time the word miniature is mentioned. And of course, I also have a Google Alert on both my names, plus other keywords. So this helps me find other bloggers who are in my field, and I visit those blogs, whether they're mystery writers or other interests that I have. I post and make comments. I interact with their blog, and eventually I get to guest blog on their blog. So the world of blogging, which I'm sure younger people, younger than I, probably know a lot more about, blogging is another essential for promoting your work. And the final one for promotion is to find a niche market. And then going back up to selling your mystery, when you write your query letter to your agent or publisher, an agent you would like to represent you, you mention the niche market. You tell them, guess what? Not only mystery readers will love my book, but everyone who knits, or everyone who runs visits a beauty salon or a dry cleaner, because that's the focus of my book. So my niche markets for the first series, the periodic table mysteries, are every single physics and chemistry department in every college in the country. So I built a mailing list. I send out a little package, a press package. I send out different things depending on whether I think I want to travel there. For example, I got an invitation to visit Bryn Mawr in Philadelphia and give a talk to the chemistry department and be their guest for the day. I was willing to do that. I might not be willing to go to every school, of course, and I can't go to every school. So you choose your press packet and you design your press packet according to whether you simply want to alert them that you have this wonderful series that fits right in with their interests and their students' interests, or whether you would like to visit their campus. Locally, I've been to many high school science classes, and in fact, my books on the periodic table, my mysteries, have been used as textbooks in a couple of local high schools. And as a combined science-English assignment in a junior high, where junior high students were required to storyboard my books. And this was, of course, very exciting when a 12-year-old has read the book, even though it's not meant necessarily for children. But because it's a cozy, it's okay for kids to read it. And so my books are in the schools, in the science departments. For this niche market, the new one, dollhouses and miniatures, I built a mailing list. Of course, I belong to Miniature Society. I belong to National Association of Miniature Enthusiasts, NAME, NAME for short. I belong to NAME, so I get their newsletters. I built a mailing list from everyone who advertises in their magazine and from their own website where they list every miniatures store in the country. And I built my mailing list from that. Send out postcards, the cover of which is my book, and on the back is a description, and in some cases have offered to visit their store, do a book signing, and in other cases just to send promotional pens. For the periodic table mysteries, I made up a little periodic table advertising my book. For the dollhouse and miniatures mysteries, I made up a ruler, a 6-inch ruler. Who can do without a 6-inch ruler if you're into crafts? And on the ruler, of course, it says Margaret Grace, Murder and Miniature, and my website, dollhousemysteries.com. So my niche market now is dollhouse shows. And just for another really fun success story, I went to my college reunion near Boston in May. I learned that there was a dollhouse show that same weekend, about an hour away. So I went to the dollhouse show. I wasn't selling my books there, but I did, of course, have all my cards and pens and rulers and a few books to give away. I came to a booth staffed by the biggest dollhouse magazine that we have around in our country now. And they were there, of course, selling subscriptions and so forth. I already do subscribe, but I stopped to talk to her, and my book had just come out at that time. My first miniature book came out in February, and this was May. So I had the book with me, and I said, I wondered if you'd be interested. I'd just love to give you a copy. You might enjoy it. And I described the book a little. And so she took the book and thanked me very much. Well, a month and a half later in July, the July issue of the magazine, this person had decided to offer the book as a prize to the readers, and they held a drawing. So in the July issue is essentially an ad that I didn't pay for. It's a column width, maybe 6 or 7 inches with my book cover, and a little blurb that said, I met the author, Margaret Grace, and I thought I'd share the book, and please write in if you'd like to be part of the drawing. And then this latest issue, again, the ad was there with the book cover announcing the winner. So I'm using this story to emphasize to you that you can do a lot of advertising that you don't even pay for if you're willing to. Of course, it cost me a book. It cost me $6.99 to give that book away, and I got 2 months' worth of advertising. And this is what you do. You learn to leverage the kind of marketing that you do. And you don't be afraid to give away your product, so to speak, because what you're trying to do is establish a wider community so that hopefully by the time you write the fourth book in the series, everyone will already know about it and you can just stay home. Well, not really, but you see what I mean. What I did for my second book in this series, which was actually my 10th mystery, but the second in the Dollhouse series. I went to all of the lists that I belong to, Cozy Mystery Corner, the MWA list, the California Writers Club, which is another wonderful networking organization, and to some of the miniature lists, Small Stuff, that I belong to, it's called Small Stuff, and I offered a book through a drawing. So all you had to do was send me your name through an email, and I entered you into a drawing. For the readers in my list, I made miniature scenes, a little reading scene, chairs. I make a lot of the material. Some of them I buy and assemble. I do all the little knitting myself. I knit afghans, and I do the crafts. So I offered a scene for anyone who sent me a name, and I had a drawing. I ended up making about 7 scenes, one for each list, and shipping it to the winner. For the other list, the miniature list, because I'm not as good at the craft as the professional miniaturists whom I see at the shows who do amazing work, I would never offer them a miniature scene. I would be too embarrassed. So I offered them a book, an autographed book about miniatures, my mystery. And I got a wonderful response from all of them. And of course, you build up your mailing list that way, and you get what we call, you get buzz going. So the 5 promotional things, again, website, networking, show up at the bookstores and libraries, blog, and find a niche market. And that's the promotion. And I think I have maybe just a minute or two to kind of review what I said today. Writing the mystery, like writing any fiction, you want a cohesive, entertaining piece of fiction. You make your metaphors fit your book. If you think of a wonderful metaphor, as soft as a baby's face, bad metaphor, bad cliche, but it would actually work if you were writing a book about babies and you said instead, soft as little Mary Jane's face. You make your metaphors fit your novel. I have a friend who just started a postpartum mystery series. How's that for a niche market? Everyone who's ever had a baby. And so you make your characters grow in the book. You have a special, unique character about your setting. You have your metaphors fit your book, and you make sure that your plotting follows the conventions of the subgenre that you've chosen. When you go to sell your book to an agent, you tell them, you tell her or him all the compelling things that we've just talked about. You don't try to write a query package until you have learned the protocol, either through an online source or writing classes. I also teach writing classes. I teach ones that are specifically aimed to marketing the mystery, and others if you just have an idea. And all of my classes are on my website. So you sell your product to your agent by talking about what's compelling and by showing that agent that you've done your homework, you know all the protocols, you know what's supposed to be in the first paragraph, what's supposed to be in the second paragraph. You are not hamstrung by writing it the wrong way. So you've written it, you've started to sell it, it's now in all of the Barnes & Nobles, and in all the independent bookstores, and now you're promoting it through your networking and your conferences. And that's about it. I'd like to mention my website, where I have also indicated classes and other things, which is, you can find me at minichino.com, M-I-N-I-C-H-I-N-O.com, or through my new website, which is dollhousemysteries.com. So I don't know if you're there, Vivian, if
yes,
you have
questions.
Yes, of course.
I've been hanging on every word. Camille Minichino, thank you. This has been a fascinating discussion. I've learned so much about writing and networking for this particular genre. I can really hear your analytic mind at work here. It's incredible. So I have a question, just to go back to the beginning. When you were talking about the formulaic writing,
mm-hmm.
it seems to offer... I find formulas to be very freeing in that you can actually let your imagination go
right.
pretty wild if you know where you have to come back to, if you have those parameters. Can you speak to that a little bit?
You know, that's a great way of saying it, Vivian. Sometimes I apologize for using the word because a lot of writers or maybe readers, they think, oh, we have to be creative and let us, you know, go off wherever we want to go. And that may be fine for journal writing, for example, which I don't encourage. I never encourage journal writing to my students because I think that journal writing gives you bad habits if you intend to publish. If you intend to publish, you need to know the formula. You need to know how to frame your story. Whether it's a mystery or a first-person essay or a nonfiction book, you need to know how to frame it. And that's another way of saying formula. And I love your idea that when you have that framework, then you can be free and you're not simply winging it for the whole book, which produces maybe something that might have been popular in the 60s, stream of consciousness, that has no conclusion or no downbeat. But right now in the publishing market, people, the publishers and the booksellers, are extremely conscious of specifying the category. They want to know where to place it on the bookshelf, how to market it, where does it go, what is it? And I find that comforting, even though many people might find it stifling. But I think the way that you've put it could take away that onus for many people who think that formula is a bad word. Of course, I grew up with formulas and I love them. So it's a good word to me. But yes, indeed, once you know your formula, you then don't have to worry about it anymore and you can be free to write within it.
Well, I think it seems to me that then you can, by your example, your characters have a great deal of detail and a wonderful character arc to them. You can spend your time on finding where these characters must change. That's something else I found fascinating, is that each character has to shift from beginning to end. And I have a question about how you handle that with a recurring character.
Well, that's another extremely interesting question. The series presents its own problems, even though I love a series because, you know, you've written 8 books with this group, you know them really well and you kind of love them, actually. But what you do is you have what I think of as a spiral, so that in each book, your character learns something. Now, these little arcs, they don't have to be monumental. You know, she doesn't have to go from being a wallflower to leaping tall buildings. But in smaller ways, she learns something in each book. For example, in the first Dollhouse series book, my character Jerry is a widow. She started a project with her husband 2 years before, and it was a model of the first home they lived in. She cannot bring herself to work on that. She is stuck. Because Ken is gone, she cannot work on that project. However, her granddaughter, and I won't tell you the whole story, of course, but what happens in the book is that her granddaughter becomes interested in miniatures. Her granddaughter, who's 10, is aware that Geraldine can't bring herself to get back to the project. So her granddaughter works with her and brings her back so that by the end of the book, they're working on that house together. So the dollhouse becomes, if you will, something like an objective correlative in a mainstream fiction book. It becomes the thing that symbolizes her growth. And so she grows in that book in that way. Now, then in the second book, there's a different fear or a different challenge that she hasn't been able to meet, and she meets that one in the second book, and so on. And then over the course of the series, of course, she grows considerably. But with each book, you give her something that she has to overcome, some fear or something that has her stuck someplace. I don't know if that's clear.
Oh, very clear. And they're deeply personal and they're deeply universal.
Yes. Yes. And that's the trick, of course, is to make each of the challenges, or, you know, they're all things that we can relate to. In this book now that I've just written is the fourth one in the second series. I think that's correct. And she hasn't dated, for example, in any of the books and doesn't have any interest in it. And this doesn't mean that suddenly she's going to go out and do speed dating and, you know, take over the disco world. But she grows in this book in that direction of being able to entertain the idea of having another man in her life. And, you know, who hasn't been through this in one way or another? You know, most of us have been through these challenges and these fears that we need to overcome. And it's wonderful. I mean, writing is therapy, isn't it? In many ways.
Yeah. That's marvelous. And I don't want to take up all the question time with mine, so I'm going to open the lines. Is that all right with you?
Fine. Uh-huh. Wonderful.
This is Michelle, and I want to say I really enjoyed what you've been talking about, very thorough, and I understand a great more than I did when I started, so I appreciate that.
Good, thank you. Uh-huh.
I have a question. You said briefly about name changes. You have a pen name, and you've changed your name for this. I understand where a pen name comes from, but what is the purpose of that?
You know, the purpose of that these days is much different from old days when, for example, a woman would take a man's name or use initials to hide her identity, and it would be a secret. And in fact, even as recently as about 10 years ago or so, pen names were a secret. I remember a guy named Tim Myers wrote under the pen name Elizabeth Bright. And for a long time, we read crafts books by Elizabeth Bright, not knowing it was Tim Myers. And then he had a great unveiling. It was a secret, and partly because he was a man writing in a pretty much a woman's field, the crafts mysteries. But now, the reason for a pen name, we use a term called branding. You know, we want to brand the writer. Camille is the person who writes the science mysteries. Margaret is the person who writes the cozy crafts mysteries. And it's a branding so that you're identified with that, and it's a whole, almost like a franchise, Michelle, if you get my meaning, that you are now, this is an entity in itself, a new name, a new series, new characters, and it's all of a piece to market it. And now it's not a secret, and frankly, it boggles my mind a little bit that we don't work to keep it more of a secret, but that's not what they're interested in. If you go to my website, you'll see right on my Margaret Grace website that I'm also Camille and vice versa. In fact, if you open the book, the paperback of my first mystery in the Dollhouse series, it'll say Margaret Grace is the pen name of Camille Minichino. So many people say, well, why bother? But the publishing industry, in its wisdom, has determined that when you change series, when you are doing something different, then you also change your name and it's a new branding. Let me just give you one other reason that I think is very legitimate that you don't hear too much, and that's this, that if you're known for one series and you write another, you meet a lot of resistance from readers. I don't know if you've ever read Stephen King's Misery, but that book, you know, that says it all. You know, you're writing this character and now the readers think that character is theirs. If they pick up a book and they don't find that character, they're disappointed. Sarah Paretsky writes a wonderful series with a private eye named V.I. Warshawski. She wrote one book out of that series. It did not do well. P.D. James wrote a book out of her series. Did not do well. Stephen King's latest literary venture, which is not one of his own genre, didn't do well. Because people open Sarah's book and say, oh, where's V.I.? Never mind, I don't like this book, and don't give it a chance. And it's nothing that is to blame. I find myself doing it. If I read a book by an author I love, and I've come to love his characters, and suddenly he's done something different, I get frustrated and annoyed. And so changing a name says, don't expect that same thing. This is something new. I don't know, does that help you at all in understanding that?
It really does. It explains a lot more because I understood pen names to be like what you said, very secretive. And so watching this new thing, I didn't understand because no one has a problem explaining it, you know, oh, so-and-so is different.
Right.
So
right.
Then you also have a different website then for each of those.
I have a different website, but they're linked.
They're linked, okay.
They're linked. So when I give out my little rulers for the miniatures, it has that website on it, dollhousemysteries.com. When I give out my periodic tables, it has minichino.com. But if you go to either one, you just click to get to the other one.
Thank you so much.
Welcome. Welcome. Thanks for your question.
Well, that was a wonderful illumination of this phenomenon now with the unveiled pen names.
Yes, and, you know, it was a very good question because it certainly is confusing. It was confusing to me when I first learned about all this of, you know, well, is this supposed to be a secret or not? And, of course, again, it's the branding. It's almost as if Coca-Cola decided to put out another drink, so they give it another name, so that you're not expecting that taste.
I have a question about publishing. I see that you actually have some Kindle books that are delivered wirelessly. Some of your
right. The new series is available on Kindle.
Mm-hmm. And what brought you to that choice about having it using electronic delivery?
That's the publisher's choice, Vivian. Actually, your publisher decides whether it's going to be. If you go to Amazon and some books you can search inside and some you can't. That's the publisher's choice. And so the publisher for this one decided that Kindle was worth a shot on Amazon and not for the others. How your book appears, whether it's hardback or paperback, is another incredible lecture itself, whether you choose your hardback or your paperback. And this is done when you're first selling your manuscript. And you work with your agent as to whether you want a hardback or a paperback contract or a hardback or paperback publisher. And I did have hardbacks for my first series, and I found that the audience, first of all, the time between books was way too long. The time between hardbacks is at least a year, often 15 or more months. And meanwhile, your readers are waiting. The time frame for paperbacks is more like 6 months. And, of course, now I realize this means I have to write 2 books a year. Why didn't I think of that when I asked for this contract? But they're out faster. My book, first book came out in February, the second in August, and there'll be February and August of coming up. But I wrote 2 books last year, and I just finished the second book for this year. So I've written 4 books in 2 years, and that's a lot. But I'm happy because readers then, you build a certain momentum with readers. There's a certain status with hardbacks, of course, but even that is changing. It used to be that Publishers Weekly, for example, would never, ever review a paperback. They just didn't. They reviewed hardbacks only. And Publishers Weekly is, of course, the magazine that you want to be reviewed in, especially when you're starting out. And all of my hardbacks were reviewed in Publishers Weekly. But now, guess what? Publishers Weekly also reviews paperbacks. Not as many, but they're building toward it. And in fact, the first book in my series, My Miniature Mysteries, was reviewed in Publishers Weekly. So that landscape is changing a lot. So the rules about hardback versus paperback are different. That used to be more of a status, and a lot of people who are original, they're called PBOs, paperback originals, if they appear first in mass market paperback as opposed to first in hardback and then in paperback. And PBOs had less status, if you want, than hardbacks. But that's not true anymore. First of all, paperbacks get a much broader print run and much wider distribution. They stay on the shelves longer. And as I say, there's a shorter lead time between the production, and they are now even getting reviewed by the trade magazines that are the most important. But that's a decision that you make with your agent when you're asking for her to represent you and to market your book to sell it to editors. Essentially, you tell her, I want only hardback, don't even bother with paperback or whatever else. And this time, as I was moving from one series to another, I told my agent that I really this time wanted to try. I'd never had a paperback original, even though my hardbacks were printed eventually in paperback. I've never had a paperback original, and I wanted to try a paperback contract. And so she got one for me, and I'm very happy with it. And the Kindle part, that's all of your agent deals with that, whether the foreign rights will be sold. My first miniature mystery was just the rights were sold for printing in the UK, so that'll be out. I'll be getting paid in pounds. My husband says, that's good. You should go there and spend it. So, but all of that is what your agent works out with you, how it's going to appear.
Wonderful. Thank you for clarifying that.
Mm-hmm.
And we are still open for questions from our wonderful registrants, and we're so happy that you took the time to join us and to sign up for the Writers Telesummit. It's the first of its kind, and we have this incredible roster of authors giving us their very best tips and their very best advice. It's an opportunity to get on-the-spot coaching with a best-selling author of two mystery series, as well as some memoirs. We have Camille Minichino ready to take your questions. So who's up next? We have plenty of time left, so if anyone has a question, of course you know me by this time. After 9 hours together, I think you know me well enough that I will. What do you think is the hardest part of your genre? Does something particular stand out, Camille?
The hardest part of writing it?
Anything about it.
These days there's a lot of competition as far as getting your first one there. So that's always the most difficult, is to find that unique, that niche that hasn't been done yet. And that takes a lot of research. I mean, you have to read a lot of mysteries to learn and to find out what's already been done. Now, this doesn't mean that you can never set a book in New York or that you can never set a... But, you know, if you want to do a hitman in New York, you're in trouble because Lawrence Block has that wrapped up. So one of the most difficult things is researching the genre that you're in and finding out what's already been written and make sure that you have a unique twist on it. And while I'm thinking of that also, the research aspect of it shouldn't be neglected, because one of the things I thought when I set my first series, as I said, in a city that I knew very well, but I still had to go back and see what it was like today, not 30 years ago when I lived there. So there was a lot of research involved in that. And also writing the periodic table elements, even though I know a lot about them, I still had to research the current trends, the nanotechnology, and so forth. I thought when I started my Dollhouse series, I wouldn't have so much research to do, especially with a fictitious town. Well, it turns out that because I named the town after Abraham Lincoln, I'm now doing Lincoln research. So I read Doris Kearns Goodwin's big book on the Team of Rivals, and I've read the biography of Mary Todd Lincoln by Janice Cook Newman. So I end up doing research anyway. And, of course, I love it. I don't mean to say that I'm disappointed that I have to do it, but it takes a lot of time. And one of the hardest parts about that is you have to balance. I could go off and read about Lincoln all day, but I know that I have to write the book. And I might read an entire 2-inch book, which is actually what Team of Rivals turns out to be, and get only a paragraph out of that I can actually use. So it's hard to kind of reconcile yourself to the fact that hours and hours of research may give you only one line. And this just means that you have to enjoy what you're doing. If this is just a job, then it's not going to work, because it's hours when you're not reading yourself for pleasure, when you're not shopping or knitting or doing golfing or whatever else you like to do. So you have to really enjoy the writing process. The research has to be also enjoyable to you, because you have to get it right. Mystery readers are very picky. If I can tell you one funny research story.
Oh, please, yes.
My first book, again, set in Revere, I put a nuclear power plant in the city because I needed a source of physicists to be victims and to be suspects. So I drove out to the far edge of town where the dump is, and I put a fictitious, of course, nuclear power plant there. And when the first review came out of the book, it was written by a local reporter in Revere, the Revere Journal. And I was a little nervous, since I hadn't lived in the city for some years. I hoped I got the spirit of the city correct. And the journalist wrote, "Oh, yes, Camille really got the spirit of Revere. However, she made a mistake. And the mistake is she put a Starbucks in Revere, and Revere doesn't have a Starbucks." Okay, so no problem with the nuclear power plant that doesn't exist in Revere. But the Starbucks... I thought, well, what do I make of this? Either people would rather have nuclear waste than a Starbucks, or the fact is they bought into that one big fiction that there's a huge lab in Revere, and they bought into that. They understood that there had to be a lab in Revere for my series to work, but they were not about to abide having a mistake like a Starbucks, or that a street is the wrong way, or that the bus stop is really two blocks down. So you have to do that kind of research. Mystery readers are picky that way, even though you can feel free to put a nuclear power plant in your town.
That, there's a certain degree to which people are willing to suspend their disbelief.
Exactly, you know? exactly. So, but that's it. If you say that she went into the Revere Theater and sat in the red plush seat, someone will call you and say those seats were changed to blue last week. So you do have to do a lot of research for that. A lot of that is eliminated when my town is fictitious, but now that I've just finished my fourth book, I have to remember whether in the first book I said the seats were red or blue.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
So there's a lot of bookkeeping involved when you do a series.
Somebody will call you and say, what happened? Did they remodel?
Well, you know, that's always an out. Oh, didn't I tell you they remodeled? So you can always kind of plug the hole, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But, again, I have to keep extensive charts and lists of what I've already said, not only whether the character has blonde hair or red hair, but, you know, what else I described and gave a detail of. I can't say that she hates the opera in book one and have her enjoying it in book four. And these are sort of what you might think of as throwaway things when you mention something like that. But you have to be very careful to keep track of all of that.
How do you keep track of it?
I keep a chapter log for each book. So that helps me within the book to keep track of what I've said in the book. And then I just keep those back. Each character, I describe each character in each book at length, and I keep that description. That's not just a physical description, but a description of likes and dislikes. And every time I mention something in a book, I add it to that list. If suddenly this time, for example, it became important in this book for her to have a certain kind of skylight that worked with the plot I was setting up. So I had to go back through all the other books in this series to be sure that I didn't say something about the skylight that would preclude my having it different in this book. And I ended up noticing that I did not talk a lot about the skylight so I could use what I wanted in this book. But I have to keep going back to those earlier books. Now, fortunately, with the computer, all I do is highlight the other novels on my hard drive so that I can easily go back to book one, two, or three in this series, do a search for Ruth, for example, if I don't already have it in my chapter log. But it's very important to keep that kind of record of what you said. I have another chart where I have listed for each book the victim's gender, occupation, the weapon, so that I kind of make it equal number of female and male victims and killers, and equal number. You know, disperse the weapons and the motives so you don't always have a woman killing someone over jealousy, you know, for example. But you vary the motive and the gender and the weapon. And I keep a chart for that. Lots of charts, which I like, actually.
Yes. Given your background.
So I hope that's been helpful, and I hope that I'm really, really so grateful to you for the opportunity for this interview and this talk. And I hope that the attendees and got something out of it. And in fact, if anyone has a question, they should feel free to email me with a question.
Great.
That they might not have had a chance to ask this time.
Oh, marvelous. What a generous offer. And we can find you through your website.
You can find me right through the website. The easiest way probably is to remember Minakino.com. And you can email me through the website.
Excellent. Camille Minakino and Margaret Grace, thank you so much for talking with us about your extraordinary process and your infinite wisdom in the marketing and promoting of the mystery series.
Thank you, Vivian, and thanks to everyone else.